Welcome to the Lean and Modern Government Executive Panel Series, sponsored by Microsoft. This month, we are discussing connected government. Here's your moderator, Francis Rose.
Welcome to the program. Thank you very much for listening today. My guests are Andre Mendez, Chief Information Officer and Chief Technology Officer at the Broadcasting Board of Governors, Susie Adams, the Chief Technology Officer at Microsoft Federal, and Dave Hebert, the Internal Communications Chief at the U.S. Geological Survey. Thank you very much for coming today. It's great to have all of you with us. Dave, I'm going to start with you. The concept of connected government, what's your definition at USGS? What does that mean when you talk about that internally there?
About connected government. I would say internally that the idea is that employees, that leadership, that everyone at all levels is able to communicate with each other, whether that's personally or virtually, when they need to do their job. Mm-hmm. And whether that's information exchange from leadership down to employees, whether that's employees finding ways to exchange information with each other to do their jobs, I think it's the sort of processes and the tools and the culture, the behavior, which is usually the hardest part, of making sure that everyone has what they need to do their job, that they can connect with people that they need to connect with to do their job, and that, and I think this is really important, that they can connect with their leadership in a way that helps them understand why the leadership makes the decisions they do, why things are happening the way that they're happening, and that they have an opportunity to give feedback to the leadership about the way that they think those things are going. So at a high level, that's how I would describe it.
Andre, how's your concept of connected government different or the same as Dave's at BBG?
Well, obviously, a lot of what Dave said resonates with what we do. We have a relatively large challenge because we operate on a global basis and across just about every time zone. So we want to make sure that everybody has access to all the information that they need, not only in order to communicate up and down their chain, but also to have access to all of the materials that they need on a constant basis. So it goes beyond personal connectivity, and it goes on to work connectivity, so that regardless of where you are in your office or not. So a creation of a completely virtual environment that allows you to function, you know, unfortunately sometimes, 24/7.
Susie, what he's talking about, I think, is the concept that we're starting to see more agencies go to, which is the idea that connected doesn't just mean the technology. The end user is really the focus on this. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And both descriptions are what we typically hear when we talk to federal agencies today. And it really goes to the anytime, any device, anywhere kind of mantra, being able to work the way you want to work. It's really the new world of work. And I guess I would add one other facet to kind of the concept of connected government, which is also the citizen facing. I kind of divide it into two buckets, the information worker inside the federal government being more connected with the people and the data that they need to get access to or have contact with to do their job more efficiently, having better devices and better tools and software, which is obviously what we're very focused on at Microsoft, is making sure that our software can be available to you on any device, anytime, anywhere, on a browser, on an Android, on an iPhone, on a Windows phone, whatever the device of the day is, as they come out so fast today, but also to provide tools and better ways to communicate with citizens. And what we're finding now is that the connected citizen is also a very big piece of the connected government kind of way forward. And in reality, what we're really looking at is kind of how do we provide the fifth generation of IT, those tools and capabilities to government information workers so they can improve the experience of citizens and also the information worker themselves as we go more into a telework and new world of work kind of scenario.
Dave, you referenced the culture, and that concept is probably, as you said, the most difficult thing to drive because it's requiring your internal customers, the employees at your agency, to do things differently than they've done them before, and everybody hates change. How do you demonstrate to the internal customers that this is going to help you, this is going to be to your benefit to be connected in this way, to be able to collaborate in this way, so that they buy into it at least a little quicker than they might have ordinarily?
Sure. I think, you know, there's this big push in government right now for customer service. Susie sort of touched on that. I think that there should be a push. I mean, I think customer service and some of the models that the private sector has done a great job of sort of perfecting or refining serve as a great sort of model for government to look at, you know, how should we be delivering the product of government to the citizen? But if we expect our employees to deliver good customer service to citizens, then I think we've got to we've got to deliver good service to our customers internally. Mm-hmm. And that has to be demonstrated through the leadership, showing that they're committed to making employees the most important asset they have. So at the U.S. Geological Survey, for example, over the past year plus, we've been working through a strategy where we're trying to get folks, and I should give a little background here. We have almost 9,000 employees, most of whom are scientists, in 400 locations across the country. And they're in very different scientific disciplines. They have, you know, different programs, different funding models. And so it's very easy for them to just focus on my work, my center, my project, and forget about the big picture. But the big picture is really, you know, the mission of the agency is the value of all of that kind of science being brought to bear on complex issues like climate change and natural disasters and those sorts of things. To best deliver that mission, they all have to be looking at how they can work together to address those issues and then deliver useful products to the citizens. So mm-hmm. our leadership has been pushing this concept of, or this question, how am I making the most of the survey's resources? We know through the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey and other input that our employees are very passionate about the mission, about the agency, or at least their version of the mission where they work. So we're trying to capitalize on that by saying, are you doing the most you can for this bureau, not for your part of it, but for the whole thing, and making the most of its resources? And our leadership, our acting director in particular, has demonstrated through the use of tools like blogging and town halls and an ideation tool we have that we call IdeaLab and a variety of other channels and methods that she really wants that connectivity. She wants that input. She knows that, you know, the we are smarter than me concept is true, especially in an agency with so many PhD scientists and other experts, that the most powerful sort of expression of our mission can only happen when people are connected that way. And it's the technology is important, but really what has to come first is the attitude that connection matters, mm-hmm. and that it's the only way the mission can be best delivered.
Yeah, and I want to make a kind of a point of clarification. When I talk about connectivity in our conversation, that's what I'm referring to, is the people-to-people connectivity rather than the technology, the wires and all that stuff. Andre, that connectivity issue, when you talk about a worldwide mission, mm-hmm. I imagine becomes even more critical than it's ever been.
Oh, absolutely. Both for our employees because of their geographical dispersion, but more importantly for our audiences. You know, the Broadcasting Board of Governors actually operates the widest distribution portfolio of any broadcast company in the world, going all the way from shortwave broadcasts, you know, the legacy shortwave broadcasts, to Twitter and social media interactions, right? And so it is extremely important that we have the ability to both import content and that connectivity from our end users and the citizen journalists, for example, as important as it is to then being able to deliver it to them. So, you know, we look at this situation as a supply chain environment, quite honestly, in which is kind of unique in the broadcast environment, where we treat the ability to move content around and the ability to establish connectivity between people as our most important mission, you know, across all of our platforms. And that involves, you know, the ability for everybody out in the field to feel like they're at home, and everybody that's at home to feel and can operate as if they're in the field. So, you know, although, you know, we talk about here about the connectivity on a personal level, that really is enabled by this wondrous ubiquity of connectivity for all of these different people mm-hmm. that the technology brings to the table.
Yeah.
But for us, it really is transforming our mission almost on a constant basis, because we've gone from being mostly a push environment to being a push and pull environment on a constant basis, with some of our most compelling content coming from people that are interacting with us for the first time mm-hmm. when they contribute that content.
Now, I know a little bit about broadcasting, having been in it for 29 years now, and I know that the people in our community have been interested in connectivity on whatever the tools were that were available at any given time. Yeah. Does that mean that your internal customers are more receptive to new ideas about connectivity, or does that mean that we're set in our ways, we like the way we've been doing things, and we're a little grumpy when it comes time to think about new ways of connectivity?
We run the entire spectrum. For example, our journalists on the field are so desirous of new ways of getting content, especially because sometimes they work in hostile environments where, you know, going around with your typical journalist setup of, you know, that multiple kilos of equipment and bulky stuff, is just not a good thing. You know, it puts you right in the scope of some very nasty people. So they're very welcoming of technologies like mobile phones that have, you know, 13 and 41 megapixel cameras, and they can capture, you know, high-definition content in a little piece of equipment where 5 years ago that would have to be done with a $100,000 camera that would weigh, you know, a substantial amount that would require a backpack and so on and so forth. So those people are very willing to adapt those new technologies, as you can imagine. Now, back in the office, you know, and in your typical government environment, the change is a little more difficult. But I have found it absolutely remarkable that when it is introduced in the proper way, that people really take to it. And for our employee population, one of the most popular concepts is the virtual presence that is enabled, for example, by a tool like Link that we're running on Office 365, that allows people to telecommute now in a more much more vivid way. Mm-hmm. Right? They are at home. They plug in one USB cable into their Surface Pro 2 that we're deploying now, and they're in their office. And with the camera that that we provide them, I can call them at home during their telecommute, and as if I walked into their office. So they are welcoming that because it brings benefits to them. And so the change aversion becomes, you know, less and less of a factor as people realize that there are advantages to this.
Susie, it strikes me that agencies are responding to two pressures when it comes to connectivity. On the personal level, they're responding to the expectations of their internal customers and their external customers. And both of our guests have talked about the citizens and what the citizens' expectations are. How much are you seeing when you go around to your customers inside government? How much are you seeing that their responses and their the things that they want to know about from you are being driven by their external customers, the citizens that they interact with, and how much with the people that work for the agencies themselves?
So I would say it's probably about 50-50, actually, and it really depends on the mission of the agency. Obviously, some missions, if you go to the Department of Defense, they have a very different mission, say, than some of the civilian agencies that we deal with. But for the most part, I'd say it's 50-50. And I do think the big challenge here is having that consistent experience so that people are willing to adopt that change, because change is difficult. And the pace of change from the IT industry is at a pace that's probably never been seen before, just with the different phones and the different user interfaces that come out. Right? People, we release things now to the web literally monthly and weekly. So you go into your user interface for your email and your emails change somewhat. And it's, you know, it is kind of that concept of change is a little frustrating depending on what age group you're in, is what we're seeing. And so one of the things that we really are trying to do as we move into this new world of communication is have a consistent user experience regardless of the device. Whether it's a phone, whether it's a tablet, whether it's a larger desktop or laptop computer, so that you have that consistent experience, so you don't have to learn a new tool as you move back and forth. And what we're seeing as people apply that both internally and externally is that they really appreciate that, right? Because now kind of we're blurring the world of work and home to a point where there's really not much difference, whether you're using Skype, for example, in our place, or Link, right, or another tool, right, that should all have that same kind of consistent user experience to be able to communicate the way that you need to communicate to get whatever it is you're trying to get done.
Mm-hmm. Andre, expectations. How do you think that expectations will change, and what do you think will drive the changes in expectations from your end users over the next, say, year to 3 years, and how does that fit in with how you're planning to strategize to meet those expectations?
Well, I think that to a large degree, people have really started to become inured to change, because as these technologies became more part of the consumer realm, right, they were less of an imposition, for example, from an IT department. And so as they're seeing their kids adopting these technologies, as they see us, continuing to welcome them, because a lot of it was brought into our place, right? You know, the bring your own device, which now can be connected, empowers those users to a certain degree. So I think that the expectations for them is that there's going to be a continuing set of evolution of these capabilities. And I have actually seen a sort of a dramatic shift in people's abilities to adapt to that change. In our agency, historically, it had been a kind of a slow-moving environment. And recently, by virtue of new leadership at the board level, that was very pragmatic in terms of what was happening in the media world, that had to accelerate at a very quick pace. The first 6 months, 12 months were kind of very difficult. But after a while, people came to the realization that, you know, the advantages that were being brought to the table were actually very good for them. So I think that their expectation now is that this change will be continual and even accelerating. So it's very interesting to see across all age groups, seeing an adaptation to the pace of change.
Dave, are you seeing that at your agency? We just have a minute or so left, but I wonder if you're seeing that also at USGS, where the receptivity to change, at least on a technological level, is changing based on people's expectations outside of work when they bring their expectations to work.
I think so. I think that, again, going back to the culture and behavior thing, that what people are far more resistant to is the notion that the organization is changing in ways that they may not like. But I think we're getting to the point where, you know, people who are really, really good at web or digital development, they don't take their products into a black box and let the current product kind of, you know, malinger on and then come out a year later with a whole new thing. They do evolutionary changes that you know, one day you just wake up and it's a better product than it was. And as Andre said, people are very, I think, adaptable and getting more and more adaptable to the concept that this stuff evolves all mm-hmm. the time. And that the expectation is that my iPhone works really well. Give me things that work as well as my iPhone. I don't want to have to think about it.
Yeah.
I don't want to have to be an expert in the technology to use the technology.
Yeah, Susie, it seems to me, just to wrap up, that seamlessness is really, if you can hit that, that's the sweet spot, right?
Absolutely. It has to work. If it doesn't work and it doesn't look the same and you don't have that consistent experience as you move between, you know, the hours of the day, whether you're doing work or you're at home or both, which typically happens right now, especially in the Washington, D.C. area, then you're not going to be happy with that solution and you're probably not going to adapt to that change.
Our conversation on connected government continues in just a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. We'll be right back.
Modernize by connecting your agency with cost-effective, familiar tools optimized for the cloud. With access to the same set of rich services in-house or in the cloud, your agency can be better connected with each other and with citizens. Learn how Microsoft Office 365 can help your agency collaborate and connect across agencies, enhance citizen experiences, and streamline productivity for efficacy. Visit Microsoft.com/government today. That's Microsoft.com/government.
Welcome back to our panel discussion on connected government, sponsored by Microsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. My guests today, Dave Hebert from the U.S. Geological Survey, Susie Adams from Microsoft, and Andre Mendez of the Broadcasting Board of Governors. And we were talking, folks, about the idea of expectations. We talked a little bit about internal expectations, what your people inside your agencies and organizations are expecting. The other end of that is what your external customers are expecting, how they want to interact with you. That strikes me as dramatically more tricky because you don't know every single expectation somebody has. You can guess at them and make them pretty educated guesses. But Andre, I want to start with you here. Since you're dealing with people all over the world, you're theoretically exchanging information not just with the social media tools or other tools that we're familiar with here in the United States. I imagine you have journalists that are trying to navigate Weibo, if they can do that in such a way that to not be detected, the social media site in China and others around the world. Talk about meeting those customers, those end users, where they are in order to be able to connect with them on the level that you want to.
Sure. It's actually one of our biggest challenges because with the number of countries that we target and the very diverse economic aspects that they bring to the table, it brings us that widest portfolio of any broadcasting company, right? So we could be targeting somebody, let's say in Malawi or Somalia, that is listening on a shortwave radio that is hand-cranked or solar-powered because there's no electricity and batteries are too expensive, all the way to people in Shanghai. That are very affluent, but they're very interested in finding out exactly what's happening within their government and within their country, and that have access to satellite television and the internet. And so in order to fulfill that range, we have to make sure that we're constantly listening to their choices of consumption of content. Because it continually migrates and at a very, very fast pace. You know, I spoke about Malawi and Somalia, and the truth is that you look at the African continent and you see a veritable explosion in connectivity, right? You know, millions of cell phones that we have discarded as Generation 1, Generation 2, and Generation 3, and that are now being refurbished and sold at much lower prices in the African continent, that bring to the table connectivity that these populations have never had before. And so their expectations rise dramatically because all of a sudden, you know, some of the scratchy shortwave radio that they were listening to before is no longer good enough. And they want to participate. So we have to provide them with the apps and the tools that allow them to become participants, fully engaged participants in this, you know, bilateral relationship that is new media, mm-hmm. right?
What does that do, Dave, for strategizing and developing an infrastructure to meet the expectations of your scientists and the people that gather, the citizens that use the data that your scientists gather?
I think it's important that we're meeting people where they are, that we're not forcing them to go outside of channels they're comfortable with, creating competing solutions to things that already exist and are, and frankly are better than what we could come up with. So if we know that a particular audience, and I think this puts a good burden on those of us who do communications. If we know there are particular audiences that are looking for particular information and they spend time in particular places, we should be giving them what they need where they are. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot more of a burden to figure out who are those people, where are they, what do they need. An illustration occurred to me a while back about the government delivering services and data, and this will resonate with people with kids or people who never managed to grow up or both, as I fit firmly into those two camps. If you go to the store and you're looking to buy some Legos or whatever your favorite building block toy is, and you see a fire truck, there's a box, there's a picture of a fire truck on it, inside are instructions and pieces to build that fire truck. But if you're so inclined and so skilled, you could build a helicopter or you could build a house. And I think where government is going is it's not saying, well, we have a little data we can give you, the rest is stuck behind a firewall, but you can build a fire truck with these parts. And instead going to the point where you say, here are all the Legos you want, you mm-hmm. build whatever you need and whatever you want. And we also would be happy to work with you to build things that we've never had before, that are bigger and better than what we've had. And I think that's where government provides, you know, its expertise on what to do with those pieces. But mm-hmm. it's not telling people what to build or how to build it or keeping it from them. It's taking all the parts and going, you know, go forth and build.
Yeah. Now, I know you can primarily speak only for USGS, but is it your sense that your colleagues in government are more comfortable with that concept than they were, say, 3 years ago or 5 years ago when there was a tremendous amount of discomfort? Oh, we don't know what people are going to do with this data. We're scared about how this might be used. Has that fear dissipated, do you think?
I think so. I think that people have seen the benefits of opening it up. You know, we were discussing before using tools like Twitter to gather information about people's experiences in earthquakes. Mm-hmm. The USGS also does that with climate change or climate information, where they ask people to observe bees and butterflies in their gardens to see when they, you know, when they're pollinating plants or doing kinds of things that they typically do at a certain time of year and stopped doing and maybe moved to a different time of year, and provide that information to us. I think a lot of the hesitation on the part of an agency like the USGS is actually from the other end, ensuring that the data we're providing has been checked quality control, that it's been peer reviewed, and that we're not putting things out there that aren't really ready for prime mm-hmm. time. And there's also always sort of, you know, this concept that this is my baby. I'm not ready to give it up yet. But I think people are seeing the benefit of that, and they're seeing that that's a tangible delivery of government mission. And
yeah.
They can go, I did that, I released that stuff, and people built these things with it.
Yeah, that's a pride of ownership issue. That's a pretty basic human need, Susie. That sounds like a really good way to demonstrate to a team inside an agency that, hey, this is okay to let this stuff go, and it's not going to disappear just because somebody's going to go use it.
Yeah, I really do think it's a cultural challenge, to be honest. I mean, it's just the way that people have done business for so long, right? I have data. If I'm going to release that data, I have to make sure that it's been scrubbed, that it's unclassified, that people have peer-reviewed it. And then when I release it, it's on the proper media, right, behind a firewall, on a server, mm-hmm. in a data center that's manned by, you know, people with clearances. And I think what we're finding now is people, I think they have kind of crossed that bridge. and have come to the conclusion that, yes, we need to make the data available. I think we're still struggling, depending on, you know, who you talk to, on where to put that data and how to get that data out there, because there is a lot of it. A lot of it's unstructured. A lot of it's, frankly, not digital right now when you go talk to certain agencies, and they are struggling with how do I give the citizens access to it. And then once I put it out there, because there's a lot of data out there already, how do I make sure the citizens have the tools they need to be able to find that data? And that's, you know, if you look at what data.gov and some of the mandates out there are all about. And you can see, you know, it's matured over the years, but it's still not that easy to be able to go out, for example, and find the data that Dave just talked about. How do I need to know where that website is. Maybe I can go to Bing or to Google, right, and do a search. It might come up. It might not. You know, so there is, you know, who has that authoritative data source, and how do I actually use that to my benefit, I think is still a pretty big challenge. And that goes to, you know, if you look at one of the big trends, it is big data. And how do we know that that data is authoritative data and is, you can make informed business decisions out of it?
Yeah.
And if you look at the tools that are out there now, I mean, you could use Excel to go out. You no longer need a data scientist to be able to look at the Twitter feeds, right, and a number of other things that are happening across social media to pull that up and actually see trends, right, in a bar chart, whereas before it probably would have taken weeks to get that kind of analysis done. And so I think the tools are there. I think the willingness to let the data is out there. I think we're still struggling with the best way to do that, to make sure that the data is kept up to date and that the people that are using the data feel confident that the data is actually authoritative, right? And they're making good business decisions on sound data.
Andre, I want to go back to something that you talked about just a moment ago, and that is the idea of listening to your end users and communicating with them directly to understand how they want to connect with you and receive and give you information. Is that just the straight up old fashioned listening to people and dialoguing with them however you're plugged into them? And if that's the case, then how do you anticipate new ways that people are going to want to communicate with you in the future?
It's a tremendous challenge because people have are enormously desirous of providing you the information, especially in some of the situations that we encounter in some of our more restrictive regimes. And so they will find any possible way of communicating with you, including, you know, letters, telephone calls, you know, via Twitter, via SMS, via email, you name it. They will try to do it. They will try to upload videos of circumstances, which in itself presents a problem. As Susie was talking about, you know, the integrity of the data going out, right? We also have a tremendous challenge in verifying the integrity of the data coming in. Mm. Because as much as we love the fact that citizen journalists provide us with tremendously compelling content, unfortunately, a lot of times, that tremendously compelling content is manufactured, fabricated, and fed to us as reality when it really is not so, just by virtue of the environments in which we work. So, you know, we have to accommodate just about every single way in which they want to communicate with us. But at the same time, if you're going to be a journalistic organization with journalistic principles, you have to make sure that that what you're getting in is reality rather than a fabrication. So there's a challenge layer of scrubbing the data on the way in. Interestingly enough, some of the technology out there is enabling that by virtue of, you know, GPS location that is built into the metadata of video content and audio content. But it requires, you know, another level in scrutiny in terms of that.
Dave, that idea of verification and cleanliness of data is not something that I think a lot of people probably think about when you think about connectivity in government, the subject of our conversation. But as Andre points out, it's tremendously important, because if I'm not looking at you face to face, if I'm 100 miles away or 1,000 miles away, I'm relying on the technology between us and then what's in my brain to see if what you're sending me makes sense, or to try to figure out if it's even you that's sending it to me.
I think in some ways this isn't really a technological problem. It's a policy problem, and it's making sure that if we always had great, for example, the USGS has very vigorous peer review and sort of data quality standards. Technology, barring some massive revolutionary change in the way that human beings exchange information, technology probably won't change the sort of spirit or philosophy of those standards, but it will change sort of the way that the information is brought in and all the different wrinkles, as Andre mentioned, the possible, you know, sort of curveballs that we're not expecting. But if you've got good policy in place, you've got good practices in place, you should be able to adapt that to technology. But but the point stands. I mean, I think it's not an area that I have a lot of experience in, but it is something we've discussed at the USGS about just taking data in from the public and incorporating it into sort of our body of knowledge and what we produce. We're supposed to be reliable experts in a particular field. It's not sort of just the Napster of, you know, scientific information where who knows what's being exchanged or downloaded on a computer. People need to know they can rely on what we're producing. Mm-hmm. And so that burden is a heavy one to make sure that we don't take things in, turn them into a product and put it out, and then find out that we've put a lot of people in a really bad spot, whether they're citizens or legislators or land managers or what have you.
So Dave talked about curveballs, Susie, and the idea that whether it's data connectivity, a data exchange, whether it's the person-to-person piece of this, things crop up that you weren't expecting, that you don't have a plan for. And I wonder if there are best practices or a standard operating procedure, or if each of these potentially these wrinkles that people run across in agencies are unique and have to be dealt with on an individual case-by-case basis.
I actually don't think it's unique. I think it's a combination of having that connectivity and being so connected. And earlier we talked about, you know, literally you're working almost 24/7 now because you are so connected. And so whereas before something, you might have gotten an email and that might have alerted you to something new or an issue that you had to deal with. Now you can get a text message, a phone call. I mean, it's almost, you know, the number of inputs that you can get to actually disrupt what you're trying to do during the day is pretty overwhelming. I would say for a federal information worker, but also for the citizens as data is being pushed to them and how they're communicating back. And so I think what we're seeing now is kind of as we move into the next generation of communication, the ability to kind of triage these things and the tools that we have. And whether that's through, you know, the way that we manage email or the way that we manage Twitter, you're going to start to see just, Dave mentioned that using tools or building tools for the sake of having tools, we've all started to realize that we really don't want to do that anymore. That there are tools out there today that allow people to communicate, and we should take advantage of those and then build on top of those or put a layer of abstraction above those, right, to kind of take out that noise and be able to disseminate, you know, the noise down to other people, whether it's delegating or putting those and prioritizing, you know, how you're going to address each of those. And I do think it is, you know, again, just kind of the new world of work and the new world of communication, and it's that whole communication used to be unilateral, now it's bilateral, and that is a huge, that's a lot of input to take in during a day when you have a, you know, you already have a 60 hours a week work week. I think it is, you know, that is one of the challenges I think we have to overcome, especially in the IT industry, is how do we deliver better tools that help you manage all that noise so you can quickly filter out things and prioritize. And I think we, you know, in the IT industry, we do an okay job at it. I think we're going to see the way that, you know, we do email. I can remember when we didn't have email. Sometimes I wish we'd go back there with the number of emails you get in your inbox now. Yeah. But it almost becomes overwhelming. And when you add Twitter, right, and other social media tools onto this, you can find yourself, you know, literally trying to look at, you know, how am I going to organize my day to be the most effective that I can be as an information worker in the government and serve the citizens that I'm supposed to be serving. And it is a real challenge. I mean, we're in the information age and it's information overload. And I think that's where you're going to start to see a huge uptick in the number of tools that are available to information workers to help them kind of filter out that noise.
Yeah, and that's actually where I wanted to go to wrap up this segment, Susie, is it strikes me that the providers, like your company, will be the leaders rather than the agencies at saying, hey, we're going to innovate in such a way and add this to something that you already use to make your work time more effective and more efficient, because those are the two things that it strikes me agencies need the most, given where we are budget-wise now.
Absolutely. And you're already starting to see it, you know, with our new operating system, Windows 8. You can see now we have a single device that does consumption and creation. That was really the big trend, is you had multiple devices. I can remember you walk through an airport and everybody's unloading, you know, 18 devices as they walk through. Now what we're realizing is what people want is a single device that allows them to do the creation type of work that they have to do their job, but also gives them the consumption to be able to take in the data, whether it's from citizens or reading, you know, whatever news and whatever consumption information they need to read right there, but not have to switch out The tool, particular tool they're using, or the and be able to switch easily between tools. So whether it's a large medium or a small medium, be able to have that single tool to do their job. And I think the big thing you'll see as we start to look at this again is you're going to start to see the ability to filter out kind of and prioritize things that you've never seen before with that as you grab that data. And I think that's how we're going to move forward.
This is the Connected Government panel discussion sponsored by Microsoft, and we'll continue on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com in just a moment.
Modernize by connecting your agency with cost-effective, familiar tools optimized for the cloud. With access to the same set of rich services in-house or in the cloud, your agency can be better connected with each other and with citizens. Learn how Microsoft Office 365 can help your agency collaborate and connect across agencies, enhance citizen experiences, and streamline productivity for efficacy. Visit Microsoft.com/government today. That's Microsoft.com/government.
Welcome back to our discussion on Connected Government, sponsored by Microsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. I'm your moderator, Francis Rose. My guests today are Dave Hebert of the U.S. Geological Survey, Susie Adams of Microsoft, and Andre Mendez, the Broadcasting Board of Governors, and it is terrific to have all of you with me. We talked about collecting information through connectivity, and this, again, like a lot of the themes of our conversation today, applies to both internal and external customers. Dave, I want to start with you because my sense is that the way that you collect information through connectivity is primarily through internal customers, but is that the case?
Yes. As far as I'm aware, there's a lot more internal exchange of information. And I guess I would expand the concept of internal to be sort of across or pan-government.
Yes.
And that's a really important part of this connectivity concept that, you know, a lot of the issues that government is trying to address, this sort of, you know, sort of society's greatest challenges, can't be resolved through the org charts and hierarchies of you know, federal agencies and the titles of people that sort of populate the top. They have to be addressed by sort of the best group of experts and the sort of minimal number of those experts needed to address a problem, and people who are willing to lead sometimes and to step back sometimes. So that exchange of information across agencies is very important to us and within the agency, and I think that's happening a lot more than input from outside of the government sphere, but it's still happening, and I think, you know, the we talked about those policies and procedures.
Yeah.
Very important to make sure we're consistent across the board in that exchange.
So what's that exchange like in a federal government structure that is notorious for stovepipes and for very vertical information exchanges, where horizontal information exchange is not nearly as easy?
You know, it's funny. We probably, in a lot of ways, behave a lot better when we are interacting with citizens. I should have mentioned this before. This is a better answer to a question you asked me before, but another way that we're opening up data and finding that it's useful is through the concept of challenges, where agencies say, hey, public, we have an issue that we can't resolve, at least in an expedient and cheap manner.
Mm-hmm.
Here's, you know, $50,000 to anyone who can figure this problem out. Within the government sphere, again, I know I'm harping on this behavior and culture thing, but before you can ever get to what information and in what form would be best to share with these people, it's, well, whose logo is going to be first on the press release?
Right.
Whose title is most grand and important and impressive? Whose mission directive most closely aligns with this activity so that we can be in charge and tell everybody else what to do? I think we've got to get past that. If government is going to deliver its mission most effectively and most powerfully, it has to look at itself as sort of this amoebic body that can bring together actually a pretty impressive sort of spectrum of experts to deal with the problem. I think Deepwater Horizon, the oil spill,
mm-hmm.
a few years ago was a great example. Our director at the USGS was part of the team responsible for figuring out how much oil was coming out of the ground and how are we going to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were scientists, there were engineers, there were lawyers from BP, there were all kinds of people involved. And they did a great job of that ebb and flow of I'm leading now, I'm following now. And the guy who figured it out was not an executive. He was a scientist who used a groundwater model because it had, you know, I think there were similar characteristics to the oil to figure out what was going on and how to stop it. He won a Service of America medal and was named Federal Employee of the Year. It wasn't about this person's title is above this person's title, so therefore they get the credit and they take the lead. I think government's got to start. It's got to, and I think it is looking at how it addresses issues that way.
Yeah, Andre, that's a classic problem. It's not a government problem. It's any kind of organizational structure. Anywhere there's an org chart, people are sensitive to Bigfooting somebody that they don't want to Bigfoot. And I wonder if you're seeing that both at BBG and among your colleagues in government that you talk to, that not lack of sensitivity exactly, but the willingness to say it doesn't matter who gets the credit. This is an old leadership tactic. It doesn't matter who gets the credit as long as the job gets done.
Certainly, the type of spirit that we want to bring to the table, from a leadership standpoint, I think it's the only way to create a team that is fully functional and where you maximize the talents that you have working, you know, in your environment. At the organizational level, there are a lot of other circumstances, for example, for the Broadcasting Board of Governors, that come into play as well. We are a part of public diplomacy, so we have to be very aware of the role that is being played in a particular situation by the State Department, by our interests in the region, despite the fact that we have a firewall in terms of the objectivity of the content that we deliver. And so, there is this constant interplay between allowing people as much range as possible, while at the same time working within a framework where there is not complete disruption that is introduced by a rogue agent. So that is something that always goes back and forth. But at the operational level, removing those barriers is absolutely essential to success, because otherwise you are limited by the individual at the top of the chain. And that's not always the best way to do business, you know. From a leadership standpoint, it makes no sense to me to do business any other way.
And Susie, the topic of this conversation is connected government, not leadership principles in government. But it strikes me that so many of the things that we've talked about apply to the concept of connected government. They're standard issue things that leaders at all levels in all kinds of organizations think about that are not unique just to the idea of connected government. These are important principles that just happen to also apply in this area. Is that a fair way to put it?
I absolutely agree. If you look just at the culture of Microsoft, if you've been following Microsoft at all, really big announcements, and we now have this concept of one Microsoft. We've changed the way that people are reviewed to actually help that information sharing. And more importantly, I think if you look at just how people communicate, we used to be in a very asynchronous world that was just very tied by an email, and that email had an SLA of 48 hours. You were okay if you responded within 48 hours, to more of a very synchronous world where it's all very real time, and where we're communicating, not just through what we consider, new technology in some spaces is unified communications. I think if you look at where we're going, right, the ability to get access real time to experts around the world, to be able to have them communicate in a matter of moments and actually see each other so you can see the body language, how they're responding to those questions, right, is going to be key to changing kind of, just the pace at which communication grows. And for example, imagine a day where you could have a piece of plexiglass standing there, and it looks like the person you're communicating with that's halfway around the world is just on the other side of that. I mean, that's reality today. That technology exists, right? Getting it to the consumers is going to be kind of that next step. And I think when you start to realize that no longer is the day of sitting around a boardroom, right, having a conversation, meaning that you can actually read that person, you'll be able to be anywhere in the world, right, and do your job and get access to the people that can help you do that job more efficiently. And I think that's really the key to changing kind of the culture and where communication goes, both in the enterprise and in government, though, because I do think it applies to both.
Dave, you've talked about policy a couple of times throughout the course of our conversation. And I wonder if, when I think about the kinds of communication possibilities that Susie's talking about that exist, I think about the rate of acceleration of technology, it strikes me that it would be very easy for the policy to get way behind the ability or the capacity of people to communicate, exchange information, and so on. Is that a risk, or is that potentially a benefit that people can be creative without worrying about violating a policy because it doesn't exist yet? Or could it be both?
Yes. I know that's probably not the answer you want to hear, but I think it is. It is both. And I think policies have to be written in order to further the mission, not to restrict people. But it is, you know, I don't write a lot of policy, but it seems that it is alluring to write policy specific to particular technologies and particular behaviors when you could really be painting yourself into a corner in a very short period of time by doing that. So I think that the spirit of the policy needs to be, you know, keeping in mind, are we making sure we're not breaking the law? Are we fulfilling our mission? Are we serving citizens? You know, those sort of, you know, high level philosophical goals, not micromanaging. You know, I'm not really sure how the government is going to adapt policy-wise to that. I know Congress has struggled a lot with the internet and legislating the internet. I mean, it's the Wild West, and
right.
The law always seems to be a step behind. It's going to be very interesting to see if we can adapt legislation and policy to things that change on an hour-by-hour basis.
Andre, you were nodding your head very vigorously in agreement with Dave when I was asking him about risk or a benefit or both. What do you see when it comes to the idea of policy and how it applies to connectivity in the way you do it at BBG?
It is an ever-present situation. When you look at how communication has evolved throughout the centuries, right? The speed has continued to increase, right? The connectivity has continued to increase. As Susie mentioned, I mean, we are creating a stage where there's basically complete and total geographic abstraction. At the same time, so it doesn't matter where you are. You got all your data, you got access to everybody. I mean, you can wreak an enormous amount of damage, you know, regardless of where you are, on an instant basis on a Twitter feed, right? And so at the same time, you have all of these situations that have now gone to real time, from asynchronous to synchronous. So the ability to react on an immediate basis has that ability to both create very wonderful situations, including an enormous amount of stimulation between citizens that are now operating to a certain degree as a collective brain that bring value to the table, right? Crowdsourcing, for example, right? You know, content supplying from remote regions, right? But at the same time, you have all of the dangers associated with being able to manipulate large amounts of the population with one single source of information, because before it's verified, it is available to hundreds of millions of people. You know, yes, it is a huge problem, but it is a problem that is sort of has evolved throughout the centuries, right? The newspapers have done that. You know, the telephone did that, where you could inform people instead of waiting for a cable to go across the Atlantic on a boat, right? So we're just dealing with a situation where the technology is constantly challenging the limits of both the human ability to adapt and the limits of the laws that govern it. And I don't know that there is an easy situation, right? But it is almost an evolutionary type of environment where what you will see is some evolutions away from the norm. And if they are positive, they will be adopted and become part of the substrate. And if they are not, hopefully they will be eliminated and fall apart in a very, you know, Darwinian process. So, you know, when I look at these types of risk-reward type of situations, nature has basically dictated how these things are going to happen. And you can try as much as you want to stay in front of that tsunami, but it has historically not been a successful endeavor.
And Susie, the way that Andre frames it, I take as a positive, because if I can paraphrase you, Andre, it sounds like what he's saying is we figure this stuff out eventually. We find solutions eventually. You know, he talks about the evolution through various types of technology. So maybe it would behoove us to take a step back and say, hey, we're going to figure all of this stuff out, no matter what technology becomes available, no matter what you and other companies throw at us, we're going to be able to manage it if we just kind of take a deep breath and think our way through it. Is that fair to say, do you think?
You know, I kind of agree with Andre. I mean, if you look at cloud computing and just kind of the challenges the world, right, has met with the regulatory and compliance requirements, we had this notion that we could just store data anywhere. And it wouldn't really matter. And we take advantage of the economies of scale, and everybody would be happy. If I, you know, they wouldn't care what country their data lived in. And what we've learned is data location, data access matter, and they're going to continue to matter until the regulatory and policies, right, on a worldwide basis catch up. And so I think it is a little bit Darwinian, and I think it is based on necessity and need. And if you look at just where we're going in the federal government with policy, right, I know, I mean, we are not caught up with the current pace of change in IT with the policies. I mean, some of these policies are 15, 20 years old in some instances and don't apply at all to what we're trying to do now. That does cause a lot of cycles and a lot of cost to the American taxpayer. And I think that if we look at just the pressure now that's on the agencies to decrease the costs of running their data centers from a data center consolidation, now optimization perspective, right, the pressure there is going to force the change. And while we all wanted to, you know, and try to force that change earlier, we didn't have a lot of success. And now there's the need, and the need is there. And I think we're going to see it happen much more quickly than we ever thought before, where people are going to be willing to change the policy because the benefit is just so enormous, right, to that policy change that it outweighs the risk. And we're already seeing that, right? And I use cloud because it is a great example of it with the adoption of cloud. Whereas some folks would said, you know, basically, I would never do that. I would never store my data in another data center. They're doing it now. And they're doing it because the price point is so compelling that they just can't afford not to. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what will help us with the policy challenges in the government today.
I want to thank you all for joining us for this terrific conversation on Connected Government. Andre Mendez of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, Susie Adams of Microsoft, and Dave Hebert of the U.S. Geological Survey. Thank you all for being here. And thank you for listening and watching our discussion on Connected Government, sponsored by Microsoft. I'm Francis Rose, Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for listening to the Lean and Modern Government Executive Panel Series sponsored by Microsoft on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. This month we discussed connected government, and the entire discussion can be found on demand at federalnewsradio.com. Modernize by connecting your agency with cost-effective, familiar tools optimized for the cloud. With access to the same set of rich services in-house or in the cloud, your agency can be better connected with each other and with citizens. Learn how Microsoft Office 365 can help your agency collaborate and connect across agencies, enhance citizen experiences, and streamline productivity for efficacy. Visit Microsoft.com/government today. That's Microsoft.com/government.